Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 118 for September 8th, 2011. Bully for Volkswagen! Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. Thanks, folks, for joining us once again with my cohort in crime, Mr. DeLorenzo, the auto extremist.
John, it's great to be here. It's been a great show, but it's NFL opener. I can't stay.
Oh, you're not running out to go hear the president's speech?
No, NFL opener. Right. I forgot about the speech.
And also with us tonight is Todd Lassa from Motor Trend and Motor Trend Classics.
Good to be here, John. Yeah. Go Pack.
Go. Yeah, well, we know where your biases lie.
Pack okay. All the way tonight.
Hey, I'm a cheesehead by birth. It's birthright, you know. It's my birthright.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you're a cheesehead by birth. Oh, sure. Yeah. From
Milwaukee area. Yeah.
Oh, no kidding. Okay. Well, I think, you know, Green Bay has got fans all over the world.
They do.
Well, if you've ever been to Lambeau Field, it's for a game. It's like being in a college town on a game Saturday. It's unlike any other NFL experience.
Cool. And at on the Spa Grand Prix race coverage, the announcer there compared Spa to Lambeau, and this is one of those sporting venues like Lambeau Field and
Wrigley Field,
or he mentioned Red Sox.
Fenway,
right. Well, and then we should say, too, later in the show, we've got Mark Trahan from Volkswagen joining us. And so we'll be talking all kinds of Volkswagen stuff. But right now, I think we ought to talk about Saab. Well, there's still a chance to talk about Saab.
I don't know if there is a chance anymore.
I mean,
it's been excruciating.
It has been excruciating.
But that's the way these things work, you know, especially when you've got a guy like Victor Mueller who is trying everything, every last piece of desperation to keep the thing alive. It just draws it out even more. So, I mean, they put out the release this morning saying that the Swedish district court turned down its proposal for the reorganization.
Well, they refused their request to go into bankruptcy protection.
There we go. Actually, you know, I spoke with Tim Kolbeck, the North American chief,
who we've had on the show,
right? And he pointed out that it's not, from the Swedish point of view, a bankruptcy. That it's something a little bit different. He stressed the fact that it's not what we would consider a bankruptcy, but again, it's, you know, a Swedish court, so it's a different thing.
It's different, but my understanding is what it acts like it, in that what you tell all your creditors, i.e. everybody that you owe money to,
right,
that they can't touch the money that
right.
you have.
And meanwhile, the government pays the workers.
Well, it was the workers' union that initiated this because they're afraid what little cash Saab has will go wherever and that the workers will not get paid.
Right, right. So that was yesterday. Today, they announced that the district court turned down their request for the reorganization. And they point out in the very terse short release that they're going to appeal it, but, you know, so that'll drag it out even further. That's all it's going
to do. Well, all they're doing is trying to delay until hopefully some sort of cash comes in.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, their best shot at this point is from an obscure Chinese automaker, Youngman Lotus is the automaker, and then the other half of the cash infusion would be from Pengda, which is an auto dealership in China, and they would buy 50% of Saab. Well, Young Man Lotus is such a small company, and China is trying to consolidate all the Chinese automakers. They want to kind of do, I think, similar to what JAMA did to the Japanese automakers in the 50s and 60s, kind of sort it out and say, okay, you build motorcycles, you build cars, you build whatever. And Young Man Lotus is not going to get approval any more than Teng Zhong, the company that
tried to get Hummer,
was able to get approval. It's just not going to happen.
No, I agree with you. And as we've talked about a lot on this show, even if, let's say, the Chinese government, for whatever reason, approved this thing, you're talking, I don't know, $100 million in cash. That's a lot of money for me, but it's nothing for a car company. As I've said all along, they need $1 billion. And that's
billions.
Just for this year.
Billion.
Right,
yeah.
That's just for this year. So what happens? Let's say Saab goes belly up, the thing goes bankrupt. Is anyone going to rush in and buy up all the? Is there a second chapter to this story?
I don't know, unless a Chinese company wants to jumpstart into the U.S. market. Why would you invest money in Saab? I mean, first of all, there's a marketing void going on right now. I feel for the dealers because they've got nothing to go on. The only thing that comes out in the press is Saab's dying, Saab's almost gone, Saab's this, Saab's that. And, you know, they're trying to sell cars in that environment. So it's not only jump-starting the production, the assets, and all that. They need a huge marketing campaign, huge, like, we're back, we got good stuff. And that, you know, that's $200 million right there.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know who's going to, if they do go belly up, who's going to jump in and want to jump-start the brand again. I don't know who was willing to.
And, you know, the other problem, John, is that they're looking at it. The management is saying, well, you know, we're by definition a small car company. We've always been a very small, quirky as a thing. And there was the inherent problem with Saab is how do you grow a quirky company and not lose your quirky buyers who don't want to see Saabs up and down the street? Well, so the way around that is that we build premium, more expensive cars, so we have more margin on it, and we can afford to build fewer cars, 80,000 globally per year, which is still a big number for Saab. Yeah, the problem is it's just not a premium brand. It never really was. General Motors bought it bought half of it at first when it lost Jaguar and maybe on purpose to Ford.
And Volvo,
right. And then said, well, let's try to make this something it's not. And I think Mueller wants to do the same thing. The fact that they've announced, all they've really announced are three model names, 9-1, 9-6, and 9-7, that they want to build after this Chinese partnership that's never going to happen. And so the 9.6 and 9.7 presumably would be upmarket from the 9.4X and the 9.5. And the 9.5 is already a $40,000 to $50,000 car. And, you know, come on, you don't have room for that. I wrote a while ago that what they should have done was probably, and, you know, we can ask Mark about this when he comes on, is maybe try to fill that space that Audi used to have before Audi very successfully moved up market and took on BMW and Mercedes-Benz. Be the kind of $28,000 to $35,000 car for people who are tired of being in their fourth or fifth Camry or Accord.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not going to make the money. Is the problem.
I just think they're just lost in the swirling maelstrom of that price range there, and there's no compelling reason to buy.
They've got a great small, very small group of core loyalists.
And, yeah, well, that's cool.
And for good reason, because they built some cool cars, but they've always been a shoestring car company.
Yeah.
You know, they had to buy, you know, Ford V4 engines to get out of the two-stroke engine business back in the 60s. They had to team up with Alfa Romeo to do the Saab 9000, the first and only Saab that didn't have the ignition key on the floor. And, you know, they've been operating on a shoestring almost from the beginning.
Yeah, I think, in fact, if General Motors had not bought them 20 years ago, they would have gone out of business 20 years ago.
No question.
They were only kept alive because there was a parent company with deep, deep, deep pockets. Not deep enough, as it turned out, because even GM went broke, though that wasn't Saab's fault.
Yeah, they would have. I think they would have gone under after the 92 recession, that when Porsche nearly went out of business. That would have been the last of Saab, certainly.
And speaking of GM, what do you guys make of Bob Lutz going back as a consultant to the company?
Well, he left formally in May, last May, but he never stopped doing this consulting. It was kind of an informal deal. It was probably a six-month deal. It came up, and they formalized it, and they publicized it, and I think they publicized it for Wall Street's benefit.
Yeah.
And, Bob's still involved here, so,
Yeah, so there's all continuity.
That had a lot to do with it. But, Bob never stopped advising Ackerson. And
interestingly, this is not precluding him from staying on as an advisor to Lotus.
Well, that doesn't take too much of his time because they're...
Clearly, GM does not see Lotus as a threat.
That car company would be crazy.
No, of course not. But in this business, you don't...
You don't serve on two boards or two masters in the auto industry.
No matter
industry.
Who it is, right. Really, right?
But Bob's Bob, and he seems to be able to do stuff others can't.
So he was like the retired cop who couldn't stop coming back into the office and telling war stories, probably, and now he's formalized it, and to a good result, I would think. I think this would...
Well, I think, too, but I also know that not everybody wants him back there.
Oh, yeah, I know that, too.
And, because God bless him, here's a guy who's almost 80 years old, but I know there's a feeling in some senior levels there that, look, he had his day in the sun.
Yeah, he had his day.
And we want to do stuff, and we don't want this guy coming back, looking over our shoulder and slapping our hands.
Now, there's a huge faction there that feels that way. Mm-hmm.
And including some of the new people like Steve Gursky and probably until recently... Dan Ackerson. But Ackerson has made it clear that what he wants his legacy to be is that he wants to revive Cadillac. And maybe at some point he decided, someone like a Lutz is probably a good person to bring back in and do that. The guy...
One of the other things, too, is, Mary Barra, who now runs all PD, has never run PD before. And I'm sure she's sharp as a tack. But I think it's probably going to be beneficial for her to be able to pick up the phone and go, hey, Bob, I'm running into a problem. How did you guys handle this in the past? That sort of thing where it would be very beneficial to be able to just tap into Bob Lutz's knowledge.
Well, it was my take about Mary is that she is she executes programs.
Yeah.
She's not going to be the visionary that comes up with the program, but she is the person that once they're done hand-wringing about what the program is, look, feel, everything, and they hand it to her, and it's like, go get this done.
Right. She'll make the train run on.
Apparently, she's superb at that.
And to make the and because she has the HR background to appoint the right people to each program. I mean, you have after the 09 bankruptcy, you have a good number of people coming back saying, now we're looking pretty good, and there's all kinds of really interesting projects here, and everybody wants to work on the new Corvette. Not everybody wants to work on, a small car or something. So how do you, the little fiefdoms in each program, and how do you make sure that the right person goes in the right place? And supposedly that's what Vera is really good at.
But they're technically operating without a real chief of product development. I know that Mark Royce has been doing that. He's sort of been doing both jobs. But Mary's got the title, but that's not really what she's doing from my understanding of how it's working.
Well, Mark's definitely got the product background.
Yeah.
No question about it. He can do that sort of thing in his sleep.
Hey, I saw two Range Rover Evoques today on the road going nose to tail. They were going over to Lavery's in Birmingham, the Range Rover, Audi, Porsche store. And let me just tell you, this car is going to be a huge hit. It has tremendous presence on the road. I almost drove off the road. I mean, they look great, and they are going to have a hit on their hands. I don't think their dealers are ready for that. But I predict the Evoque is going to dominate Range Rover sales, probably 90%. I mean, it is a hit. If I've ever seen a hit rolling down the road, that Evoque is one.
Where are they pricing that?
They're in the they start in the 40s.
They start at 40.
Really?
Start at 48.
Right.
And I went to their site and priced one out, and it was 54.9. But I'll tell you what, it is tremendous.
You know what that may do, though? That if it looks that good, it may hurt Range Rover sales.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It will become the dominant. It will become their dominant vehicle. I'm telling you, it's going to be a huge hit.
And do they really care? I mean, the Range Rover sticks around as kind of the icon. Mm-hmm. They won't make as much money on an Evoque as they do.
Well, I've got one. I've got a Range Rover out in the parking lot right now that's $84,000.
Sure.
So I mean you don't want to cannibalize those sales too much.
But when you're talking about cannibalizing, how many? You know, are you talking about the matter of hundreds, maybe? Whereas this should do much bigger volume because it's kind of a sweet spot for a luxury small crossover utility.
But we've talked about this before. I mean, you can see all the pictures you want. You can see it on the show floor. Mm-hmm. Until you see it on the road, you don't really know. And this thing has great presence on the road.
It does, yeah.
Well, you know, and we've talked about that before. It's certainly hard for me at an auto show to judge a car until I see it out on the street amongst other cars. But that Evoque, I mean, it looks like a concept car.
Yeah, it does.
So that thing's really got a pop on the street.
So it is going to be smoking hot.
Especially give them props for doing the two-door. Because,
yes.
You know, as we all know, that two-door is going to sell well for maybe a year, and then it'll drop off. But they've got the four-door to sell.
Five-door or whatever, yeah.
Four-door hatch or five-door or whatever. I'm using that's the nomenclature we use at Motor Trend. So,
yeah.
So the two-door, three-door coupe, whatever you want to call it, it might be a fashion statement, might not sell very well after the first year, but the fact that they showed it first and then they did it, they showed that as the concept, and, hey, we're doing something that looks just like the concept, and it's a lot of attitude to say that, you know, we're going to do the two-door these days. Nobody does two-door.
Yeah, and you're right, John. It does look like a concept vehicle on the street. I mean, it's kind of like the CTS-V coupe. Mm-hmm. When you see one, it's just like, wow, they really did that. Well, the Vocus is just, you know, it really looks good.
Yep.
Speaking of concept cars, we've got the Frankfurt show coming up in a few days. We should talk about that. In fact, we're going to be doing a live webcast from the Frankfurt show. Well, we'll talk a little bit about that. But first, we're going to have to take a break here. And because we've got to thank our friends who sponsor this show. And Ben, let's give a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone. Bridgestone is featuring its third generation of run flat tires with groundbreaking new technology. Current run flat tires can offer peace of mind for consumers, but the added mass and the stiffer sidewalls can compromise ride comfort and fuel efficiency. The new third-generation Bridgestone run-flat tires reduce heat and improve performance and ride comfort. Whether you're a program manager in the industry or just looking for a set for your personal car, check it out at BridgestoneTire.com. Well, as I said, we're going to be doing a live webcast from the Frankfurt show. We're only going to give you a little taste of it because that show is just so big. We're going to be walking parts of the floor there. And that'll be Tuesday, what's that, the 13th, I think, next week. And we're going to be going live at 1400 GMT. That'll be about 4 o'clock in the afternoon in Germany, and that'll be about 10 a.m. on the east coast of the United States. But for anybody who wants to check out what we're able to show you, go to our website. We'll be doing a live webcast. But what are you guys expecting out of the Frankfurt show?
I think the Ford Evos is going to be exceptionally well received there, and I think when the Europeans get a look at it, they're going to be impressed.
I think despite what Peter said about the Jaguar, and I need to take a closer look at it, it's one of these things where I've just been busy with deadlines, the stuff coming across my desk. I think it'll get a lot of attention.
Oh, I'm sure
right,
it will.
Yeah, you know, whether it's the right kind or not. I think you're right. My quick glances at it is that it's not quite the, you know, the problem is they've got, you know, it evokes the E-Class, the production car that will come out of that, and that's an impossible car to, you know, kind of come up with, especially if you say you're not doing retro anymore, which Jaguar says it's not. I agree. The Ford's going to be a big get a lot of attention, and of course that car previews the next Fusion, which we'll see early next year.
Yeah, we'll see in Detroit,
converging with the Mondeo at the Detroit show. And
Ford's also going to unveil their, you know, of course, they're right on the red line here of unveiling the Focus ST one too many times.
Yeah.
Enough already.
Yeah.
Get it out. You're talking about it too much over and over and over. But they're showing a Fiesta ST. They're showing a 1 liter.
Three-cylinder.
Yeah,
I'm dying to drive that.
Yeah, 1 liter three-cylinder direct injected turbo, which looks like a jewel of a little engine. And they're, you know, they're doing a Formula Ford in England that's, you know, EcoBoost, and, you know, they're doing all kinds of things, which is, so Ford's going to capture some attention there.
I have to, the Kia rear drive sedan is really intriguing. You know, we were talking about Hyundai and Kia before the show and what they're trying to do. And
well, anytime a manufacturer does a dedicated rear-wheel drive to anything, it's news, positive news.
These days especially.
I have to claim that scoop a few years ago. I think it was actually on the 07 Genesis sedan launch in South Korea.
Is that it?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah.
And I asked one of the Hyundai guys, one of the corporate guys who's also in charge of Kia, well, when's Kia going to get this platform? And, you know, it obviously was already in the works. And this thing has been kind of on and off. Apparently, there's, you know, Hyundai and Kia, Hyundai owns, what, something like 70% of Kia? It's not a full ownership.
It's not a full ownership,
and
right. But they control it, make no mistake.
Of course they do, yeah. But there are, you know, I think there was a lot of infighting on whether that car would ever get done.
Mm-hmm. So. There is a lot of infighting amongst Kia and Hyundai, and that's not a bad thing necessarily.
No, not at all.
I mean, it's not a bad thing in the sense that it can push both of them to strive to do better. But when you're trying to allocate corporate resources, that can be a mess too.
Well, and in terms of allocating corporate resources, how do you separate those two brands? I mean, are you doing are you doing like one's a Toyota and the other one's a Honda, and that's one of the descriptions? Or on a higher level, it would be like Mercedes versus BMW. One's more conservative and maybe a softer riding car, whereas the other one is sportier and sportier looking. Well, these being two very new kind of brands, none of that's organic. It's all kind of being, you know, worked out in the marketing factory. How do we create a split between these two brands, a distinction between these two brands? Mm-hmm. And I don't think they quite have it yet.
You know, another trend that we see at the Frankfurt show are these micro cars that are coming out. In fact, two of the interesting ones are coming from Volkswagen and Audi. So maybe this is a good time to bring our guest up on the set with us, Mark Trahan. Mark, come on up here, because we got some questions to ask you.
Okay, all right.
Come on, have a seat on the couch here, and we'll get a microphone on you.
Yep.
So it's great to have you with us here on AutoLine After Hours. Welcome.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, now, I've known you a long time, but I've always known you with Audi. Tell us exactly what you're doing these days, because you want to talk more Volkswagen than Audi.
Well, my official title now is Executive Vice President of Group Quality, which encompasses Audi as well. But the reality is about 80% of my activities right now are focused on Volkswagen because we've got a lot going on there. We've got the Beetle being launched from Puebla, Mexico, and, of course, the new Passat coming out of a totally new plant in Chattanooga. So those are the kinds of things that occupy my time right now.
And quality has been a source of problems for Volkswagen in the past in this market.
Yeah, it has. Although I will say right now, having been in this position now for about a year,
I'm just kidding.
You got it all fixed.
No, not really. Well, that's why they brought him in, yeah. Right? Oh, it's like straighten this out.
I don't know if that's the case, John. Thank you for the confidence. But now I would say for the Volkswagen brand, we actually do a lot better today than we get credit for. But as you know,
it's hard to change perception.
Perception takes a while to catch up with reality, and that's more or less where we're at today. But nevertheless, I'm pretty enthusiastic about the brand and where the brand's going to go. And I can tell you that right now, having been with the company a while, I've never seen the commitment and focus from the top on down on this market. And it's legitimate. It's sincere. I know you've probably heard from us in the past where we've stated this, and it comes and goes. It ebbs and flows. But it's really different this time. And I think it's tangible. You can see the investment that we're making.
Oh, you can see it. And I don't think we ever believed in the past that Volkswagen took this market seriously in the sense that it would never design cars to meet the needs of this market.
Right.
It was just take the German stuff and sell it there. And even if some of the German stuff's actually made in Mexico, it was just, the Americans will just have to take this thing. And it never really worked that well.
No, it hasn't really. Not if you want to achieve the volume levels that we aspire to, because we want to be the most successful manufacturer in the industry, but not just in terms of sheer volume. I mean, success for us has a lot of definitions. It's also about the margins our dealer retains, the amount of loyalty we have with our customers, and also the way the cars look. I mean, we are a German engineering-orientated company, and we don't want to change or deviate from that. And it's interesting you say that because the earlier point you made, because a lot of what I'm doing now, a lot of what my focal activities are, is not quality in the traditional sense. Because actually, as I said, you may not believe me, but we have got data that shows that we do a lot better than we get credit for. If you look at in the CSI data right now, and that's one of the few areas where you can get an apples-to-apples comparison on sort of how brands are doing from a qualitative aspect. Because warranty data, as you would expect, is pretty highly proprietary. I know we don't share our warranty data. but there's a set of questions, but one in particular in the CSI study that it asks customers, and the CSI study goes back 3 years, every year. So the current study encompasses, I think, 2010, 2009, and 2008 model year cars. And the question asks, at that last service event when you went to the dealership, was it for a repair or a maintenance? And I used this in a press event a couple of weeks ago. And the data is actually, the Volkswagen brand is right at the top of the top quartile. I think we're sixth in the industry. 31% or 32% of the time that a customer goes to a dealership, it's for a repair. I mean, 4 years ago, that number was 62% for the Volkswagen brand. And if you look into that data, if you're so inclined, you'll be surprised at where some of the really great brands are. So, but my point with all that, and I'll shut up in a minute, is that because of that basis, a lot of what I'm doing now with my team is focusing on those softer quality items, making sure a lot of our human interfaces are easy to use, intuitive, and functional, if you will, because in the IQS data, which is what was something that we really want to get improvement in, a lot of what they look at is what I call these softer design quality items, you know?
Like what? What are you talking about when you say softer?
If a customer complains they can't see or understand how to operate the cruise control or the climate controls, they'll mark that down as a quality issue.
Mm-hmm.
And those are some of the things that are really impacting the VW brand. And that's that last 5%, because when we get that right, And you put that on top of the good quality basis we have already, because quality's got a lot of definitions. It's not only reliability, but it's also aesthetics, design, all of those things, functionality. Once we get that point right, and we will, because there's really commitment behind it, then I think we'll have a really good basis to be, what I said earlier, is that is one of the most successful manufacturers in the industry.
So you said your repair work number went from 62% in 4 years down to 31?
Yep.
To what do you attribute that? Where did you make the improvements most?
It's a lot of blocking and tackling, a lot of quality gains. I think one of the things that we've learned here, when I say we, I mean the group, is that there's more transparency here than we have in other markets. You've got longer warranties due to market requirements, but also because of regulatory requirements. You've got a lot more consumerism. You've got studies here that you don't get access to in other markets, consumer reports, all the J.D. Power study, strategic vision, you name it. And we finally figured out that, you know what, Americans aren't that different than Europeans or even Asians or Chinese. And if you utilize the information that you get in this market and you apply it for all cars, you can sort of raise the water in all markets. So an indication is, and I talked with the lady from Detroit News last week about this, one of the recent successes is we found in the IQS study last year that customers were complaining about the seat adjustment on the Jetta, not intuitive to operate and not easy to operate, right? Well, in a very short time, we've got a complete new redesign that really works. It's intuitive. We've had J.D. Power look at it. They agree. And you know what? We're going to use that for all markets because, mm-hmm. like I said, Americans really aren't that different than Europeans, Asians, and people from China.
So how is the Chattanooga plant coming?
It's difficult. And you guys have been in the industry enough to know that, you know.
Think all new plant, all new workforce, all new car.
Yep.
That's the hardest way to do it.
Yep. But it's coming along. We're building right now. We've built about 4,500 cars so far for retail consumption. And the really heartening thing for me with my job and my responsibility is that it's quality first, volume second. I mean, we're behind where we want it to be in terms of
the
launch volume. Not that much. We're making up. We're working weekends, 7 days a week. But the culture that we have down there that we've instilled in the people is really, the operative term is passion for excellence. And you really see it in what's coming out of there. But it hasn't been without its fits and starts and without its challenges. But the cars look very good. I don't know if you had exposure to one. We've had fleets that we've been running in my little team now for almost a full year. We've learned a lot from that, and the end result for the customers is going to be, I think, it's a German engineered car built in Americans for Americans, and we'll launch the official launch sale date. I think is the end of this month, mm-hmm. last week in September. So we've got about 3,500 cars in the queue that are just waiting to get out and get loaded. And some of them are actually on the way to dealerships now as we speak.
Well, it's got to be pretty exciting because Volkswagen, as you pointed out, has awfully ambitious sales goals in this country.
Yeah, but I think we can get there. I mean, just think about it. This year, we'll probably sell close to 350,000 cars. And once we have the Passat fully up online, you know, that'll add another 100,000. So that's getting close to 500,000 cars already at the end of next year.
And the goal is by 800,000 by 2018?
2018, that's correct, yeah. And, you know, that's an ambitious goal.
It's a big number.
It's a big number. You have to have targets, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe we won't hit that target, but at least directionally we're headed that way. Because, again, for us, it's also about the quality of the business, not the quantity of the business. Dealers have to be profitable because we know profitable dealers are better poised to treat customers. So I'm from Vermont, right? And my grandfather used to always have a saying, you know, happy cows give more milk. but that pertains to dealers. So you got to have a healthy and profitable dealer network. So we know that's a point in our business plan that we have to achieve, and we're on the way to do that. But again, it's about the quality, not the quantity of the business.
Hold on. We got a whole lot more to talk to Mark about, but we've got to take another commercial break right now. In fact, we've got to thank our friends at Hyundai. Ben, let's bring that one in. Hyundai is known for the great value that it offers, but let's not forget about the technology. The Hyundai Sonata is the first vehicle in its segment with standard integrated Bluetooth hands-free phone. It's the first vehicle in its segment with factory-installed HD radio technology with multicasting. And it's the first vehicle in its segment with XM Nav traffic and XM data services. That, plus NHTSA's 5-star overall crash test rating and the IIHS top safety pick, explain why the Sonata is selling so well. And you can check it all out at HyundaiSonata.com. So sorry, Todd, I was cutting you off. You had a question to ask, Mark.
Well, I was just going to say that from an industry perspective, and this might be a little bit inside baseball, at least to the average customer, but I mean, it's really interesting to look at how you are doing exactly the opposite of what Ford is doing these days, and you're doing specific models for the North American market, while Ford, across in town here is they're doing the one Ford thing, combining the European designs with the American designs. And what's it like to watch that? I mean, are you concerned that you're going in one direction while the rest of the market seems to be going in the other?
No, I mean, it's about hitting the sweet spot. Having worked with this company and interfacing still with the engineers and the top decision makers, I can tell you there's very little danger of us diluting what I would call the essence of the brand. We're an engineering-orientated company. We've got, I think, per capita, we've probably got more engineers than any other company versus, you know, engineers and normal employees or non-technical employees. It's all about optimizing. And if you look at the Passat in detail, the Passat that we're building here in the U.S., it's not totally different from the Passat that we make in Europe for other countries. But it is optimized, and some of those key optimizations that we've made for the U.S. car are focused on this market. You know, it's a little bit longer. It's got some other equipment features that we don't offer in the European market. And we've also, you know, made some equipment modifications to be able to bring the cost down as well. Almost 80% of the content is locally sourced here.
Well, and your product planning has, since this North American-specific Passat's been in the works, which is, what, 4 or 5 years or something like that, do you have a much bigger group to work with in North America than you did before? Has the kind of the structure of the product planning staff and engineering and design shifted to North America at all?
No, the engineering and development is still done in Europe.
Okay,
but a lot of the market input, of course, comes from our team that's located here in Herndon and was previously located here in Auburn Hills. And it's not that big of a group. It's the product marketing group in Reiner Michaels area is probably around 23 people. So it's not huge or overly bureaucratic.
Mm-hmm. Mark, we were talking earlier about what we're going to see at the Frankfurt Auto Show. One of the things that has been leaking out ahead of time are these micro cars. Mm-hmm. VW is going to have this, I think it's a one-seater called the Nils, yes. And Audi's got a very, very super compact electric that it's showing, too. What do you make of that trend, and would products that small ever find their way to the U.S. market?
Probably not right now, but I think in the future. I don't think you guys know the market better than I do. I think it's pretty apparent that the appetite and receptivity, if you will, for smaller cars is growing here in the U.S. But it would be a leap to be able to offer some of those smaller micro-like cars that we're going to showcase in Frankfurt next week. But directionally, I think it's sound, and you will see, obviously, more electrification here in the U.S. car population and also smaller cars.
Well, what about something like the new Audi A2, though? The first one, which was late 90s,
right.
Of course, that never came to North America.
Beautiful car, too.
Beautiful car, but also very expensive.
Yes.
And at a point where maybe even in Europe, the idea of a car of that size and that kind of cost and price, still even in Europe, pretty unusual.
Yeah.
Now, even Americans are used to, dare I say, because of Mini and maybe a few other models here and there, or Audi A3,
right?
Maybe a little bit more accepting of that. Do you think they would be for something like an Audi A2?
Well, you know, my
step too far.
Okay. First, my official title is no longer in product planning, but I mean, obviously, I'm still connected to the company.
Well, that's why we're asking you.
Oh yeah, right. I'm going to spill the beans. I'm not going to do that. But I can say that you will see cars of that ilk in the Audi portfolio in the future here in this market. That's about it. That's about as specific as I'm going to get.
That's not a big surprise.
Yeah,
so. Sure.
That's
sure.
About as specific as I'm going to get.
Okay.
And then the whole, you mentioned electrification. Of course, Volkswagen's pretty strong in diesels. How do you see that playing out in the U.S. market?
I've got my own opinions. But I think to be successful in this market, you've got to have all of those elements in your portfolio. You've got to have electrification. You've got to have some form of gas hybrid or electric hybrid. And to be really successful, I think you need diesel. Not everybody has that. I mean, obviously, being European-based or orientated, we're strong on diesel, both brands, Audi and VW, and Porsche now to some degree. And I think you have to have all three. And diesel is going to grow. Electrification, electric cars will grow. Hybrids, I think my opinion is that they pretty much plateaued, but that's just my opinion.
Well, the sales numbers would bear out your opinion.
Okay, thanks.
I mean, you know, we've talked a lot about that on this show of the general public is amazed to find out that hybrids account for maybe a little over 2% of the market. And they just, with the exception of the Prius, none of them have really worked in, from a sales standpoint or provided any kind of return to the companies that are building them.
And, I mean, we're not losing money on our diesels. We're not making a ton of money. But, I mean, you know, at least it's a viable business offering or business case. And I think you have to have those in this market. And I think there's a lot of headroom for diesel market share to grow. No question about it.
I've heard that the Chattanooga plant could take as high as an 80% diesel mix.
Our dealers have asked for that. I mean, obviously, there's supply constraints on the engine, but we're going to wait and see. Right now, I think we're planning around 20 to 25% on the Passat once we have the diesel, which would be a really cool car, 800-mile cruising range. Pretty cool.
That's a big cruising range.
Yeah, but we'll see, you know, what it does in the marketplace, and then we can adjust our business plans from there.
Hey, let's take another commercial break here, and then we'll come back and do rapid fire. We'll have all the questions from the audience here. But, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Chevrolet. Not only does the Chevrolet Cruze offer a ton of features, it features some of the best safety and maintenance in the business. The Cruze comes with rear park assist, which beeps if you're about to back into something. It has rollover mitigation, which means the car senses if it might roll over, and applies the brakes to the outside front tire to bring the car back under control. And it has OnStar vehicle diagnostics, which sends you emails about the latest status of your car. And you can learn a lot more about it at Chevrolet.com/cruise. Okay, Mark, this is the part of the show that we call Rapid Fire, and we always started out with Ben bringing up the announcement that this segment's about to start. So, Ben, let's bring it up. Okay, first question comes from Scotty in Cleveland, who says, is the Bully concept still in the plans for production? And we should say the Bully is the micro van. Maybe not so micro anymore, but Volkswagen has shown the concept of that and called it the Bully.
You know, conceptually, it's very interesting. We see there's some market interest in it, but right now it's too early to tell if we can come up with a successful business plan. I mean, you know, there are some constraints with the size of the car in this market. So right now, I can't say anything. I can't say that it is.
Okay, David says, why does the paint of many new cars have orange peel? He says, when I worked for AMC many years ago, I guess it was. There hasn't been an AMC for many years. He said, orange peel was considered a paint defect. I have a problem justifying $30,000 to $40,000 for a new car with orange peel. Why do manufacturers think this is acceptable?
Well, speaking for us, we don't find it acceptable, and painting technology has moved on quite a lot. Speaking of the plant in Chattanooga, you know, we've got one of the most advanced processes down there. It's water-based. I can't speak for other manufacturers, but we do not find orange peel acceptable.
Well, that's interesting that you're using water-based paint because, you know, the complaint about that at least some years ago was that you just could not get the depth of gloss with a water-based paint versus a solvent-based paint.
Yeah. Oh, we think we can. And I know from personal inspections of Dr. Winterkorn, we'll
have depth of gloss,
And we do. We've got a process where we don't use the old primer base coat, but instead we use a thicker top coat, and that helps give us a greater depth.
Well, paint technology is just staggering with what's happened in the last 5 years. I mean, you're seeing finishes on these cars at lower price points that are really impressive.
True, but the viewer's right. I've seen way too much orange peel on modern cars.
Really?
Yeah.
I know we don't see it on our cars. We wouldn't accept it. So, I can't speak for other brands. I guess if you're looking at a car that has orange peel, I would question the purchase.
Well, I know some people have said, if it's got a lot of orange peel, it means it's got a lot of paint on it. So,
my opinion, but if a car's got orange peel, that's going to be reflective of the manufacturer's overall approach to some quality aspects that are important to certain people.
I would agree. Hey, we've got some phone calls coming in. Ben, let's bring in the first one of those.
Hey, man, this is Youngblood, Cleveland, Ohio, calling. My comment is to Mr. DiLorenzo. Peter, well done. Very well done. You're our Detroit man behind the curtain.
Thanks, Sean.
Like I said in my comment to you, I can only hope that certain people know how to read your column. Thanks again. Thanks again for the great job, guys. Later, dudes. Bye.
Thanks, Sean.
Great. So what was your column about? What's he complimenting you on?
I channeled if there was a wizard of the Motor City, like the Wizard of Oz, and doling out advice and pearls of wisdom to various manufacturers and people in the business. So it's a lot of fun.
That's great. Okay, Glenn E. wants to know, would a diesel pickup like the old Rabbit sell today based on a new Golf? He says, I like that old Rabbit pickup.
Mm-hmm. It probably would, but I don't know if there'd be sufficient market volume to justify the investment. I personally like that car, too.
Well, yeah, but it's kind of like the El Camino.
Mm-hmm. It was an El Camino,
a little mini El Camino. Right. I mean, there's a strong faction for that idea of a vehicle, but reality is the manufacturers can't devote. Yeah.
Was that in any way exempt from the chicken tax?
I believe it was.
Okay.
Yes. And I saw an El Camino from Australia, GM in Rochester.
They still make them.
Very cool.
Yeah, Utes, as they call them down there. Yeah. Right.
You know, the Pontiac showed one 3 years ago.
That's right.
The New York Auto Show.
And if Pontiac had not been killed, it might have made it here.
Yeah, and they'd sell three of them.
Yeah.
Right. But, it's the same thing, as these guys know better than I. There's lots of interesting cars out there, but to sell them in sufficient volume to justify the investment and the tooling and all of that, it's,
Well, that's why you got to sell them on a global basis. Yeah. So you'll sell a little bit here and a little bit there, and pretty soon it adds up to real numbers.
But in this country, if you're not named Chevrolet or Ford or Ram, it is as it is now. I don't see reason to even introduce a truck in this market anymore.
Yeah, but we'll still continue to offer a nice little diesel Jetta wagon, which has a lot of the versatility that you have in a pickup.
There you go. He got the plug in.
Ding,
but
ding,
VRM
ding.
Chris wants to know, why is the Passat not available with the 2-liter turbo?
Well, never say never.
There you go, VRM Chris. You got an answer. Hey, we got another phone call here. Let's bring that one in, Ben.
Yes, this is Troy from Jackson, Mississippi.
How do you do?
I would like to make a comment about Volkswagen. I like the styling of the Passat and the Jetta, and I love the Golf, my favorite small car. I hate the styling of the new Focus and the new Kias and Hyundais and so forth. But Volkswagen has got to improve the reliability of its cars. You've got to make them cheaper to fix. And secondly, Volkswagen has got to get a more fuel-efficient gasoline engine in its cars. That five-cylinder lump that you have does not get good gas mileage. It's uncompetitive with the four-cylinder engines from your competitors. So these are some improvements I would like to see in Volkswagen. Thank you.
Yeah. He likes the styling.
Yeah. Okay. Those are all fair observations. But I would tell you that if you looked at the current cars, you'd find that the reliability is pretty good. Very, very marketable.
The old perception thing again.
We've got a 5-year powertrain warranty, a 3-year bumper-to-bumper warranty that includes free maintenance. So the cost of initial ownership is not too high, and we stand behind the car. Regarding the 5-cylinder engine, you're right. It's probably not as efficient as a gasoline direct injection that we offer in other parts of our portfolio. But if you look at the numbers, you'll find that it's in the mix. It's not deficient in any way in terms of its efficiency.
What about his point of cost of repairs?
The same thing there. I mean, cars, when they need repairs outside of warranty, are always going to require, expenditures. But we do analysis of the fast-moving parts, brakes, clutches, things like that, exhaust systems, to make sure that we are competitive with the rest of the industry. And the fact that we do have the 5-year warranty on the powertrain And the first 3 years, we include all the maintenance costs. I think, you know, that'll do a lot to offset your at least your costs in the initial part of the ownership. When you get to be 5, 6, 7 years, your cars are going to need maintenance and repair. But there, we work to make sure our prices are competitive in terms of the parts. And the current cars, as I said earlier, are pretty reliable. I mean, if you look at the stats in the CSI. Cars that are, you know, 3 and 4 years old, 2008 model year cars, they still have a relatively low frequency of repair vis-a-vis the industry average and some other competitors that you would think would do better. So there's always room for improvement, but as I said to Pete earlier, I think currently we're doing a lot better than we're getting credit for.
Okay, Glenn E. wants to know, will the refreshed 2012 Tiguan still require premium fuel?
Yes.
Okay, and Goggles Pisano here has a comment. He says, Tata should make Evoque-bodied Nanos. Yeah. Then we'll be talking selling like hotcakes.
I predict that Evoque will be one of the 2011-2012 hits for sure.
If I could go back to that other question.
Yeah.
To get
go
that
ahead.
Plug-in.
Yeah.
Yes, it still will require premium fuel, but you'll see the fuel mileage increase quite significantly. We've made a lot of optimizations in terms of the mapping of the throttle and transmission, very efficient tires, and a lot of little tweaks that will result in about a 10 to 15% EPA fuel mileage improvement.
Another question here. Why won't VW bring over the Polo or Scirocco, or at least build versions of them in Mexico?
Again, it's about investment to bring those cars into this market. And because when they were originally conceived, the decision was made not to bring them into this market. So the upfront engineering to make them compliant with our regulatory environment wasn't done. And to go back now and reverse or re-engineer those cars is extremely costly, and it just doesn't make a suitable business case. But as I said earlier, I think you'll see cars in our future portfolio that are of that ilk. But right now, the Scirocco is the same thing. There's a lot of people that would like to have that car. I'm one of them personally. But again, the volume just wouldn't be there based on our market analysis when you look at cars like the GTI, which is already here in this marketplace.
Okay, Mike DeWhite says, will Volkswagen bring more efficient gasoline powertrains to America? Right now, the diesels are the only VWs that get much over 30 miles per gallon.
The answer is yes, and the regulatory environment, again, is going to accelerate that. But we already have a pretty good percentage of direct gasoline injection cars in our portfolio. We have double-clutch transmissions, which are inherently more efficient than a regular, you know, torque converter-like automatic. But you'll see, to answer your question just succinctly, you'll see more gasoline direct injection engines, much more efficient powertrains throughout our portfolio as the years go by.
Well, and what about manufacturing? Because you now manufacture the five-cylinder in North America.
Yes.
And as someone pointed out, you know, it's been around for a while.
Yep.
And it's not gas direct injection.
Yes.
Some more efficient four-cylinders. And it's your volume engine for the Jetta and for the Passat. So,
right.
So obviously, sometime in the future, we'd maybe like to see a new engine built here that would be your volume engine for those cars.
We're currently building another engine plant down in Mexico. Again, a very, very significant investment, $500 million or something like that. It's quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Not quite as much as we've invested in Chattanooga. And the plans are for that to build engines that are consumed here in the plants here in North America. And it's no secret that Audi's looking at building a manufacturing facility here as well. And one of the things that Rupert Stadler, the current Audi CEO, has clearly stated is that if we do that, we have to have a powertrain production capacity here as well to make it economically viable.
Yeah.
Speaking of engines, Mine VW asks, why no TDI in the Tiguan? It makes no sense not to have the only SUV crossover whatever in its segment with a diesel.
Yeah. These things are being discussed. As I said earlier, we think there's a lot of upward potential for diesel, increased market share, and we're looking at a lot of options. And, all I can say is never say never.
Hey, we've got another phone call. Ben, let's bring that in.
This is Ken from Indianapolis. Never miss your show. Just wondered, with Saab being down for the count, it seems, what's the future of Spyker? Thank you. Bye.
Oh, well, Spiker was sold. Mm-hmm. Victor Mueller sold that to a Russian guy, Vladimir Antonov, I think.
Who he's wanted to bring in all along to be a major investor in Saab. It's very hard to sort that out, really, because the Swedish government or the European Investment Board did not want to approve Antonov as a...
They don't want anything to do with
him. Yeah, they don't want anything to do
with
him.
In fact, when General Motors was first trying to sell Saab and Antonov was involved, they said, we're not dealing with this dude.
Right, exactly.
So he must not be all that nice of a chap.
There's rumors about him, and, you know, there have been stories, and he denies it. I don't know. Yeah. I'd have to devote a lot of time just on that story to figure out exactly where he stands. But, yes, he's not very well liked by European investment boards and so on. So,
we also got an email from Tim and Indy who says, how much resistance was there when the DSG was presented as a technology they could produce? How tough was it to work through the bureaucracy?
It wasn't, from my recollection, it wasn't that difficult because, you know, our board members from Dr. Winterkorn on down viewed this as a desirable technology, and we are a technologically orientated company. So and the discussions centered, I think, more around making it viable in regards to cost because the initial costs were quite high. But we've been known to invest. We've been known for investing in things like that. I mean, you look at our CVT transmission on the Audi side; that has more than 10 years development. But I don't think, from my recollection, that it was a big, long discussion. It was more about cost optimization. We believed in the technology from the get-go.
Hey, Ford's running into issues with customers with dual-clutch transmissions.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
There doesn't seem to be anything wrong with the transmissions. Customers just don't like the way they shift. Have you guys run into anything like that?
Yeah, we do. We see it in the IQS study, not just with DSGs, but also with our regular torque converter transmission, because which is now an 8-speed. It's about finding that balance because the focal point sometimes can shift too much towards fuel efficiency and gains in fuel mileage. And if you don't do that right, it's going to come at the expense of drivability and shifting comfort. It's about finding that balance. So, you know, it's a constant struggle in my personal discussions with the engineers because, you know, we show them the data from studies like IQS, you know, that complain about customers. The customers complain about things like hesitation and not shifting down quick enough, and they're coming back and saying, well, yeah, but every time we, you know, move the needle more towards performance and responsiveness, then we're going to degrade fuel economy. But I think the clever engineers can find that balance where you can deliver the customer the performance that they require and achieve good fuel economy. And I think Ford and everybody else will learn that.
And then on top of it, of course, Ford introduced that transmission in North America in the Fiesta without adding any manual control of it. You can't even control it manually, even though it's a dual clutch, and it just doesn't make sense.
Jim Haynes asks all of us here, how many of those 15,000 Saabs sold this year were the GM-built Saab CUVs? Well, first off, I highly doubt Saab has sold 15,000 cars this year.
No, not
globally.
In the United States.
Not even globally.
I think it might. Well, yeah, I'm not sure. But the answer is that that in the U.S., Saab sold 65 9.4Xs last month. And I think the total since launching it here is about 83.
Wow.
83.
So those are going to be some of the rarest cars ever made in the world.
It's like getting a Solstice coupe, I guess.
Yeah. Looks like we've got another phone call in. Ben, let's bring it in.
Hi, guys. It's Jonathan.
All right, Jonathan.
New Jersey. Great show. This question is for your guest. The Volkswagen mid-engine sports car. I pretty much know the answer, but I just wanted to say I'm a big fan of the design.
Yes.
And also, out of all the dual clutches, transmissions in the mid-price, lower-price, you know, $25,000, Volkswagen's design and execution of it is the best. And I truly enjoy driving the GTIs from time to time. Thanks again. Have a nice day.
Thanks for the positive comments. In regards to the mid-engine sports car, we might surprise you.
Oh, what do you mean by that?
That's all I'm saying.
What? Well, we know that Volkswagen's working on something to slot beneath the Boxster that Audi will share and Volkswagen will share.
I got nothing.
Yeah, for those who are only listening, all we saw was Mark shrug.
Well, here, John, ask me what Volkswagen. Yeah. We'll go back to
that's
that.
Right.
Yes, they are working on a smaller mid-engine entry that Audi will use and Porsche will use and Volkswagen will have.
Fantastic.
And because, you know, remember way back when the Boxster was the entry-level Porsche, and now it's, you know, expensive. So that'll be interesting.
Well, it's expensive, but it's still the entry-level Porsche.
Yeah, and so they'd like something to come in under it. But the most interesting thing to me about the Volkswagen Group is how the hell they manage all of these. They have proved that they can do it, and I'm still amazed.
Manage what?
All their brands.
Well, you know, as we've talked about, it's because they're treated as standalone companies.
Yes.
It's not just one big mumbo-jumbo and, you know, we'll assemble these parts this way and call it this brand and assemble those parts that way and call it another brand. They're standalone car companies. I think that's what makes all the difference in the world.
But it's pretty amazing.
It is.
It is. It's going to be a strange comparison, but not dissimilar to what GM did when it did it well.
In their heyday.
In the heyday. Yeah.
In the heyday of General Motors, these divisions ran themselves.
That's how it all started. That's when, you know, Durant went out and bought Chevrolet, went out and bought Buick, went out and bought Cadillac, and all the way up until GMAD, really, that was the beginning of the downfall.
That was the beginning of the end. But you were talking about the intramural warfare results in better cars when Chevrolet and Pontiac went at it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And Pontiac was a thorn in Chevrolet's side, you know, every time.
Nobody at Buick hated Oldsmobile more than the people at Oldsmobile who hated Buick and tried to put a knife in their back.
And, you know, that's the Pontiac, as I've written about many, many times, was the pirate division within General Motors. And they went out of their way to tweak Chevrolet. And they'd come out, you know, they do the GTO. Well, you can't do that. You can't have a model, a high-performance model. It isn't. It's an option.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, it's constantly. But in GM's heyday, they did it well.
And that was only after they gave it to Bunky Knutson and then said, fix it or kill it. And he fixed it. So,
yeah.
Anyway, we're getting way off track.
Yeah.
That's okay.
That's good. There's no such thing as way off track on their job.
But that's a good analogy. The modern-day Volkswagen is
the General Motors of its heyday,
yeah.
No question. Yep. Here's a comment from, or actually really a question from Prehistoric. He says, and it's for all of us, what do you think of the Fisker Surf EV concept that's going to be shown at Frankfurt?
I haven't looked at it. Fisker is a lot of vaporware so far.
I saw a Fisker on the road the other day.
You did?
Yeah. It must have been, I don't know why. It was out.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I'm dying to see one on the road. Fisker is one of the ones that I just don't see surviving long run because I don't see where it's bringing anything new to the party.
Looks like it's going to out-survive Saab, but that's about all you can say.
Yeah, well, after the government gave Fisker $500 million.
That's,
you know,
just unbelievable.
That is unbelievable.
And Tesla.
Yeah. Hey, we've got another phone call here. Ben, let's bring it in.
Hi, this is Bridge in Washington. I was wondering why or when I could expect my Volkswagen Scirocco, when I can order that at the dealer.
Yeah, so am I. I spoke about that earlier, Ben. Right now, it's hard to get a suitable business case that would justify the investment to bring that car in here, because offering cars like the Scirocco, the GTI with the 2-liter turbo FSI engine and other cars of that ilk, the Jetta GLI, it's hard to.
And you still have to relaunch the Beetle,
right? And that's going to have the 2-liter S model as well. So it's hard to get a suitable business case together that would justify the volumes necessary to have that car.
And there's going to be a Beetle R.
And there's going to be perhaps, although he'll only shrugged a mid-engined sports car.
So. Did I shrug? I don't know.
Yeah.
So how much room is there for all of that? I mean, I agree. It's a great-looking car, but correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it weighs a little bit more than a GTI, doesn't it?
And I don't know. It probably if you think so, it does, you're probably correct. I'm not that familiar with it.
I thought I read that someplace, but I could be wrong. Mm-hmm.
Well, look, we're at the top of the hour here. I'm just scanning to see if there's anything that we've really missed that much, but I think we've got most of it covered here. And so since we're at the top of the hour, it's time to wrap this up. But Mark Trahan, thanks so much for coming on. This has been great.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks. Thank you for having me. I'd like to talk cars as well, just as you guys do.
The next time you're on, we'll talk about your private car collection, which is very interesting.
Very interesting.
Oh, yeah, we're going to have you back because we didn't get you. Yeah, we never got into that. Mark's got some pretty cool cars of his own. So. You have an open invitation to come back here.
You let me know when. I'll talk Lamborghinis all day because, after all, they are in the group.
Yeah, he has a Urama, which is one of my favorite older Lamborghinis.
Thank you very much.
Beautiful car.
Yeah, it's really, they only built 327 of them, and I wonder how many of them exist today. So every once in a while, I'll take it out and I'm thinking, geez, should I even be driving?
What color is it?
It's a Tahiti blue.
Oh, okay, cool.
Tan leather.
Yeah, very nice.
And Todd Lassa, thanks for coming on with us. Always good to have you here, too.
Hey, John. Good to be here.
And Peter, you'll be anchoring this show.
I will be in control next week. Not only Thursday night, but Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Autoline Dailies, folks.
That's right. Peter will be filling in because I'll be in Germany next week. But should be some good shows. I'll be trying to get in and watch a little bit of After Hours myself if I can do that. But anyway. Got a few more announcements here before we totally sign off. And don't forget about that Frankfurt show. As I said, next Tuesday, the 13th, will be 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 4 p.m. German Time, 1400 GMT. Check out Roundabout tomorrow night with Jason White. With Old School VizCom, he'll be talking about design. That's tomorrow at 6:30. Don't forget that you can always friend us at Facebook, facebook.com/OutOfLineDetroit. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/OutOfLine. You can always read Peter's stuff at AutoExtremist.com. Follow him at twitter.com/AutoExtremist or facebook.com/AutoExtremist. And Todd, we can always get your stuff at MotorTrend.com.
MotorTrend.com, MotorTrend Classic. I also, MT_ or whatever that's called, Lassa at Twitter, the occasional tweet. So, yeah, and we're, like everybody these days, we're multimedia. We're everywhere.
And we're talking all this website stuff. Check out our website. We've changed the name. It's no longer AutolineDetroit.tv. It's just AutoLine.tv, and we've made some changes to the website. We've got a new media player there. You can watch us in full screen. There's more to come yet, but this was a big step for us just getting this done. And thanks, folks, for having tuned in. Great having you here, as always.
Visit our website, AutoLineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with AutoLine Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at AutoLineDetroit.tv.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.